From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature interviews with two of this week's Academy Award winners. Frances McDormand won the Best Actress Award for her portrayal of Marge Gunderson, the very pregnant chief of police in the film Fargo. Walter Murch won two Oscars this week for his work on The English Patient, one Oscar for sound, the other for editing. He's won a total of 8 Academy Awards. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. San Diego authorities have identified the leader of the group of people that committed suicide yesterday. Marshall Applewhite and 38 followers took their lives over several days during the last week. Another man and woman have been identified. More names could be released today as relatives of the dead are notified. 21 women and 18 men committed suicide at a posh mansion in suburban San Diego. Driver's license found on the body show they were from several different states. Members apparently killed themselves in the belief that they would meet a UFO traveling in the wake of the passing Hale Bopp comet. Thousands of religious pilgrims marked Good Friday in Jerusalem today. The observances were held at a time of growing tension and continued clashes between Israelis and Palestinians. Lori Neff reports from Jerusalem.
The pilgrims, some carrying wooden crosses, others singing hymns, walked along the Via Dolorosa in Jerusalem's Old City, retracing the route Jesus is believed to have walked to his crucifixion. The observances took place amid deteriorating Israeli-Palestinian relations over Israel's construction of a Jewish settlement in traditionally Arab East Jerusalem. Israeli forces on high alert for possible Palestinian unrest following Friday Muslim prayers patrolled the Way of Sorrows, armed with clubs and assault rifles. Many Palestinian Christians were unable to join today's procession because they are barred from entering Israel under a closure the government slapped on the West Bank and Gaza following last week's apparent suicide bombing at a Tel Aviv cafe. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Jerusalem.
The UN Refugee Agency says it has secured permission from Zairean rebels to send home about 100,000 Rwandan refugees. They are camped in eastern Zaire, and many are in need of urgent food and medical care. The BBC's Jane Stanley reports.
The Rwandan Hutu refugees are in a desperate condition, many too ill and too starving to now go on any further. They've been trekking from one makeshift camp to another deep in the jungle since the Zairean rebel offensive began last October. Many refugees have died along the way. Aid workers say others will not survive much longer unless they get immediate help to return home. The old, the young, and the sick have been driven relentlessly further from the border with their homeland by extremist Hutu soldiers and militiamen of the former Rwandan government. They refuse to return to Rwanda because they fear punishment for atrocities they committed during the 1994 genocide. The extremists have been using the refugees as shields against the advancing Tutsi-led rebels, but UN officials say the fighters have now disappeared from among the refugees.
Jane Stanley reporting. The teenager accused of murdering Bill Cosby's son appears in court today. Suspect Mikhail Markashov is scheduled to be arraigned in Los Angeles. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the government has changed its first report on how fast the economy expanded at the end of last year. The Commerce Department revised the gross domestic product downward by 0.1%. The agency says the GDP expanded at a rate of 3.8% during the fourth quarter of last year. Hugh Johnson is the chief investment officer at First Albany Corporation. He says he is not surprised at the revision.
These are usually nuances, and they're nuances because there's some numbers that we don't have completed by the time that either the advance or the preliminary estimates are released. So you might have a revision, a slight downward revision in numbers such as inventories or exports. These are very big numbers They're very volatile numbers, so I'm not really surprised.
But the 3.8% rate is still very strong. Signs of strong economic growth have caused investors to worry that the Federal Reserve might start a series of interest rate hikes. The Fed raised a key short-term rate on Tuesday for the first time in more than 2 years. A published report says chip maker Intel and Compaq Computer are among the companies working to establish standards for a new type of computer. This new personal computer would be installed in a living room and be called a PC theater. The Wall Street Journal says the aim is to work with consumer electronic firms to make sure large-screen PCs are compatible with several home electronic devices. The report says PC vendors and television makers joining the report, or rather the effort, include Hitachi, NEC Technologies, and Toshiba. The stock market is closed today for Good Friday. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations, and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Frances McDormand won an Oscar this week for Best Actress for her performance in Fargo. The film's screenplay won an Oscar for Joel and Ethan Coen, who also directed the film. The Coens gave McDormand her first film role in their first film, Blood Simple. She was also in the Coens' film, Raising Arizona. McDormand and Joel Coen are now married. McDormand's other movies include Mississippi Burning, Dark Man, Shortcuts, Primal Fear, Palookaville, and Lone Star. Fargo is an offbeat crime drama laced with black humor. When the movie opens, a car salesman who is deep in debt cooks up a money-making scam. He's going to hire people to kidnap his wife, collect the ransom money from her wealthy father, then split the ransom with the kidnappers. But of course, the plan blows up in his face, starting with a triple homicide. Frances McDormand plays Marge Gunderson, the very pregnant chief of police in the rural Minnesota town of Brainerd. She never leaves her house without a full breakfast prepared by her husband, Norm. This is her first homicide investigation. Here she is with her deputy at the crime scene examining the victims.
Here's the second one. It's in the head and the hand there. I guess that's a defensive wound.
Oh, yeah.
Where's the state trooper?
Back there, a good piece, in the ditch next to his prowler.
Okay. So we got a trooper pull someone over. We got a shooting. These folks drive by. There's a high-speed pursuit. Ends here, and then this execution-type deal.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised if our suspect was from Brainerd.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, from his footprint, he looks like a big fella.
You see something down there, Chief?
No, I just think I'm gonna barf.
Jeez. You okay, Margie?
Yeah, I'm fine. It's just morning sickness. Well, that passed.
Yeah?
Yeah, now I'm hungry again.
I spoke with McDormand last May and asked about her first impressions of the character she plays in Fargo.
I've known Joel and Ethan for 13 years. I met them 13 years ago, doing Blood Simple, and have known them since then, and in fact have known Joel intimately since then as my husband. So when I first read the script, it was a long pause, and why me? Why am I Marge? I wasn't exactly sure. But when we started working on it, the crew was so enamored of Carl and Grimsrud, you know, the two bad guys, that I started thinking maybe Marge is the bad guy and they're the good guys. I wasn't really sure. But I think what's really great, what I always loved about Marge, is that she does lead a really simple life and has a very cozy domestic situation and, you know, a good job in a small town police department. But what's really great about her is that she is so competent in her job.
Yeah.
And the minute she gets to the, you know, the crime scene, it becomes evident that she's not everything she appears to be. She's a lot more.
She's a lot more interesting than you think she's going to be.
Yeah, I find just that whole opening where she's in bed with Norm and then they have breakfast, there's something really fascinating about their relationship. Even though on the surface it seems so kind of mundane and banal.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on there and has been for years.
Now, I read that you have a sister who's a chaplain at a women's maximum security prison.
Actually, a men's maximum security prison.
Wow.
Yeah. She's, I wasn't thinking about Dorothy when I was, you know, working on Marge. It was after the movie was done and I saw it and I turned to Joel and said, ooh, there's a little bit of Dorothy in Marge, isn't there? And he said, yeah, I hadn't thought about it either, but there is. And it's something about her approach to, my sister's very old-fashioned in a way, in her perspective on the world. Obviously in her job, working at a maximum security prison, she can't be naive and she can't be innocent to what's going on around her. But she has a lot of faith in human goodness, and I think that that's part of Marge.
The character that you play, Marge Gunderson, the chief of police, is hardly a glamour role. She's pregnant, very pregnant, throughout the film and wearing a big parka most of the time. Was that ever an issue for you that, I mean, not only wasn't this a glamour role, but it was a role where you were going to be real padded?
No. Well, I've never really played a glamour role. I mean, the only attempt I've ever made, I don't think I was very successful at, did a movie called Dark Man where I played, you know, the girlfriend. And that was the only time I ever really got to pay attention to, you know, what I wore and what I looked like. And I, in fact, found it very boring.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's really all I had to do. I mean, it's not all I had to do, obviously. I was playing a character in the movie. But what was great about Marge, it was wonderfully liberating not having. And in fact, I think I really like the way Marge looks. I mean, just vanity-wise, I feel like she looked good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I liked the way I looked. And I think that, but there was something really liberating about the costume and the padding, and I was wearing a wig and the accent. It was kind of like really similar to the clown work. And I don't mean, you know, slapstick, fall down, little cars and, you know, horns type clowning. But the clown work that I learned in drama school where we would put on kind of half masks and stand in front of a mirror and let the mask transform our face and then transform our body, then our movement, and then our voice. Every morning that I put on the pregnancy pad, the costume, the wig, started working with the accent, it was a total transformation into someone else, which is very hard to do on film as opposed to theater.
Now, you've never been pregnant, right?
No, I haven't. I am a mother. We adopted our son Pedro 11 months ago. So I've been expectant, but never pregnant.
So did you feel like you should talk to mothers about what the experience of carrying was like?
No, you know, because I had played a pregnant character before or earlier in my professional life, Stella in Streetcar Named Desire, and I had that memory of, you know, just theatrically working with it. And also, there was something about Marge that I think, in fact, Norm was much more pregnant than Marge was, in a way. It was important for me that it was just a fact of Marge's life. And I think it was important for Joel and Ethan that it was more a visual aspect of the character than something that was referred to. Do you
mm-hmm.
know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of dramaturgically, there was this idea that there was the pregnancy of the future involved in Norm and Marge's life, that they were kind of the caretakers of the future in amongst all the craziness and the tragedy and the bizarre aspects of the movie. Marge and Norm have hope of the future. But I also think it was just a visual thing about Marge. She was this large, solid piece of brown in the middle of the white landscape.
Now, the Minnesota accents have proved to be somewhat controversial. I've read that there are some people in Minnesota who are offended at the broadness of the accents. Were you already familiar with that accent before you did the role?
No,
the
I'd, I'd never worked on a Minnesotan accent before. Mm-hmm. Joel and Ethan are from Minnesota, but don't really have one. They've been away for about 20 years, so mm-hmm. whatever they had, they've lost. Sometimes in vowel sounds you hear it, but not in the cadence, in the music of it. But they'd written it into the script. It was scored. The script was scored with the accent. Every ya and you betcha and you oh geez was right there in the script. So it wasn't like it wasn't evident from the beginning that was necessary to create the music, you know, to score the script. But I'm from the Midwest, and though the vowel sounds in a Minnesotan accent are really based in the Scandinavian origin of the, you know, the group of people in Minnesota and Wisconsin, in that area, there was a really big Scandinavian immigration. So the vowel sounds and the music are originally from there, but it's also a lot about the attitude, which I've always found as an actor working on a dialect is just as important as the technical aspects of a dialect. And I spoke with one of the actresses that played, Hooker number one. She didn't have a name. Hooker number one, Larissa, who played the smaller of the two hookers, and she was born and raised in Minneapolis. And she talked about Minnesota nice.
Minnesota so, nice?
Minnesota nice is the armor there. It's keeping a smile on your face to get you through everything that you need to get through in life until absolutely necessary that you change that into something else. And what it really helped with Marge was that she always had a smile on her face because just technically it helped me get the accent. Mm-hmm. As long as I kept a smile on my face, it was a little flatter, it was a little rounder, it was a little softer, it was a little slower. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you about the food in Fargo. The food that Marge mm-hmm. eats is mm-hmm. these huge platters piled high with like beef and potatoes and steam plate vegetables and
dumplings.
Yeah, okay. It's almost as if like the special effects department prepared the platters of food for you.
That was real food, that smorgasbord. I'll tell you, it was actually a really great smorgasbord. It's just hard eating that food for 10 hours, you know. And, of course, Joel and Ethan wanted us to really be shoveling it in, so we were shoveling it in. And what's always weird about when you're eating in a scene, especially in a movie, is that you know, the audience sees you do it through one scene, but we were doing it literally for 10 hours. And in the middle of that, of course, everyone breaks for lunch, and you're the last person that wants to eat lunch. But it was what I love about that scene is that it obviously doesn't it's not expository, it doesn't tell anything about it, doesn't further the plot in any way, but it's really great character behavior. You know that Marge and Norm do this at least 3 times a week. And it's something that's very specific to my background, actually. I know whenever I go home to visit my parents, they've found a new smorgasbord restaurant or an all-you-can-eat place. You put down your $12.95, you eat your money's worth, you stay there till you eat your money's worth. And my father's always been very satisfied with restaurants of that kind. I think it's a very American tradition, you know, you get
Absolutely.
Your money's worth.
Absolutely.
It's the bounty. They call it the groaning board. Where my parents live.
My guest is Frances McDormand. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview from last May with Frances McDormand, who won the Best Actress Oscar this week for her performance in Fargo. When your husband presented you with the part of Marge in Fargo, did you say to yourself, uh-oh, what if I don't like it?
No, you know, I never even considered that because it wouldn't have mattered. There's something about, you know, I learned about movies from Joel and Ethan. I mean, the first film I ever did was Blood Simple, was their first film. Mm-hmm. I'd never done any work behind the camera before that. And besides that, the set of Blood Simple was really really special, and I didn't learn that until later after being on other sets. Their sets are very collaborative. They're very tension-free. They're very conducive to making a good movie and making friends with people that are working on it. So after work, you know, I've worked with a lot of really great directors and have been in really great situations, but I still find their sets the most fun to work on and the most collaborative. So irregardless of the fact that I know them and live with one of them. So it wouldn't have mattered what it was. I was just really excited to go back to work with them. And I kind of come to a point in my professional life where I knew that if I got to work with Joel and Ethan maybe once every 5 years for the rest of my professional life, I'd be very happy.
If this isn't too personal, did you and Joel Cohen fall in love while making Blood Simple?
I think Joel and I, it wasn't really until about 6 months after we worked on Blood Simple that we realized we were doing more than hanging out and that it was going to take a little longer to figure out what it was. And then about 10 years later, we realized that we'd lived together for 10 years, which was pretty exciting for both of us, pretty amazing. So I think, yeah, I'm sure we fell in love. At the time, it was much more about, it was a really exciting, I think both of us were starting out doing what we wanted to do for the rest of our lives, which was a really exciting time. And I think we both had the same attitude about what we wanted to do for the rest of our lives. And so I think that it was much more about a combination of falling in love in a romantic sense, but also finding someone whose attitude you respected about their professional life. I mean, it was a lot of things. It was really meeting some, you know, it was much, much more the beginnings of a mature relationship than either of us had ever been in before.
Frances McDormand is my guest, and she's starring in the film Fargo. How did you first get bit by the acting bug?
Mrs. Zelli, my English teacher in ninth grade, we were reading Shakespeare, and she had us read some of the scenes out loud in class. And then at the time, we were reading Macbeth. And we put together some scenes from Macbeth and did them for our parents and friends after school one day. And I did the sleepwalking scene, Lady Macbeth sleepwalking scene, at the age of 14, which I now think is quite presumptuous. But I would get lost in reading. Reading was my escape, and I read voraciously from the moment I could, you know, I could have a library card. And I think in retrospect, I know now that it wasn't just standing up in front of people and feeling that kind of power and that kind of excitement. It was also the idea of realizing that this very private thing that I did, this reading and this relationship I had with literature, could in fact be a public relationship with a group of people, and that's when it started.
Mm-hmm. I'm always interested in hearing actresses talk about roles for women. What have your experiences been? Do you feel satisfied that there have been good, interesting roles available for you? Or do you feel that there really is trouble with the availability of roles for women, of good roles, roles that aren't just glamour roles?
Yeah, there are not enough stories being told. I mean, there are great stories specifically about women, but also there are just better stories about people in general than are being told in movies. I feel really lucky in that I've been able to make my own personal statement in the roles that I've played. And the most sought after roles. I mean, I've played a lot of very small supporting roles in films, in television, on stage, often female roles in all of those are supporting roles. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, the nature of the stories that are being told. But I feel like even in those smaller supporting roles, I've been able to find the different story to tell. And recently, this was really wonderful. Recently, a friend called me. He was doing a script, a really wonderful script called Hidden in America. And there he called me and asked me if I would come for a short amount of time to play a role in the script, which was a mother. A really wonderful role, but not something that captured my imagination at the time. And I said to him that I really wasn't interested in doing that, but what I really liked in the script was Gus, the car mechanic. I said, who's playing that part? And he told me, and I said, well, tell that actor that he's got some competition because I really like that part. So I got a call 2 days later. The director talked to the actor who was playing Gus, car mechanic, who was a friend of his, told him that I was interested in the part, and the actor said, well, she's much better for the role. I think you should cast her. So I got to go play Gus, the car mechanic. She was Gus, the car mechanic. It was wonderful. Didn't have to change one line of the script. Didn't have to play her in any more masculine way than, you know, a man would have had to play a female role in a feminine way. That happened to be her job.
So this is actually a very good time for you in terms of your career.
Oh, life in general.
Right, I mean, life in general, sure.
It's like,
adopted son, lots of movies. Yeah,
he's
good.
Talking, he's starting his first words.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a little terrifying. You know, I was watching a tape of a short movie that I did last year with a friend and on TV, and Pedro pointed to the TV and went, Mama. I thought, oh my goodness, here we go. This is the beginning. Now he's going to not understand why everybody he knows isn't on TV. But yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, in the last 2 years, what's really wonderful I'm finding in my professional life now is that a lot of people who are coming out of film school and starting their professional lives as directors and producers in film and in the theater as well know my work. They've seen my work. They've seen a lot of my work. I've been working for 15 years. And they think of me, I'm one of the actors that they think of when they need, you know, a 38-year-old woman, a woman in her late 30s, early 40s, they go, yeah, that woman from Blood Simple. Let's get her.
Frances McDormand, great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Frances McDormand recorded last May. This week, she won the Best Actress Oscar for her performance in Fargo. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
Coming up from the archives, we hear from one of Hollywood's most respected editors and sound designers, Walter Murch. He won two Oscars this week for his work on The English Patient, one for sound, the other for editing. His other films include Apocalypse Now, The Godfather, and The Conversation. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Lives of the Monster Dogs.
The end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. The end, no safety.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Walter Murch won two Oscars this week, both for his work on The English Patient, one Oscar for sound, the other for film editing. He also won sound and editing Oscars for his work on Apocalypse Now. Murch has won a total of 8 Academy Awards. He's learned that subtle differences can make a big difference in the impact a film has on the viewer. For instance, 25 years ago, for the final scene of The Godfather, when Michael Corleone closes the door on his wife, Murch recorded all the doors in director Francis Ford Coppola's house, listening for the door slam that would signify betrayal. Murch just remastered his sound for the re-release of The Godfather. Murch also mixed and or edited The Conversation, Julia, Ghost, and Crumb. I spoke with him last spring after the publication of his book about film editing called The Blink of an Eye. He says that when he's editing a film scene in which there is a conversation, he paces the cuts according to the rhythm of the character's eye blinks.
This is something I came across almost by accident, a fortuitous accident, when I was editing a film called The Conversation, which came out 25 years or so ago. And Gene Hackman was the star of the film, who's a very accomplished actor. And I noticed that there was a strange alignment between the places that I would choose to cut the film and where the Gene Hackman actor playing this character would blink. Most of the time, an actor just has an involuntary control of when you blink. You're in the moment, and blinking is a very subconscious thing. But it was uncanny that there was this alignment. So I began thinking about it and just started to watch people in ordinary situations blinking. And I began to notice quite soon that there was a very complex, interesting relationship between where people blink and what they're saying, and even more so, what they might be thinking. What you're told in high school biology is that the blink is a device that we have developed to moisten the surface of the eye, and it certainly accomplishes this. But if that were the complete truth, then anyone entering a certain environment would set upon a certain rate of blinking that would remain constant while they were in that environment. In fact, this doesn't happen. You see people who blink repeatedly when they're nervous. You can see people who are enraged who stop blinking entirely. In a strange sense, I found myself able to gauge my own tendency to blink and then somehow reroute that so that I would push the edit button whenever I wanted to blink. And this seemed to produce the most effective places to cut.
How often do you find yourself using that as a technique
all
for pacing?
Time.
All the time?
All the time. It's a daily thing.
But this is a curious thing. Like, if you're cutting at just the moment, say, I'm ready to blink while watching a scene, would I miss the edit because I was blinking when it happened?
Effectively, you do. And that's one of the things that makes it smooth. If you think about it, film editing is a very violent thing, as I said earlier. It's you're putting people into a situation where they're watching a visual field, which is interesting and complex, and then in a so-called blink of an eye, you remove that entire visual field and replace it with something else. Now, this doesn't represent anything that we have happen to us in our daily lives. If you wake up, when you wake up in the morning, what you see for the rest of the day is one continuous shot, so to speak. You can turn your head from side to side, but there's all this intervening material in between. So the fact that cutting a film actually works, that people can look at a film and make sense of it, is actually kind of amazing.
Now, Walter Murch, you've also done a lot of sound design for films as well as editing the films.
Yes.
I want to talk with you a little bit about sound. And I know when you're doing a movie, if you just record the real sound of a situation, it sometimes doesn't sound quite right.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to fake it. You have to, like, recreate it in a more convincing way. So
right.
So let's hear some of the ways that you've made sound very convincing, or how you've used sound to create a psychological
sure.
effect. You've brought some scenes with you. What's the first scene that you brought? What should we listen
for here?
The first
scene is from the Godfather, and the sound that was recorded for this scene, which is where Michael kills Sollozzo. It's the first time that he's actually...
This is Al Pacino as Michael Corleone.
Al Pacino, right. Who he's acting on behalf of the family, which is something he's tried not to do up to this point. So it's a big turning point for him. The sound that was recorded for this scene was absolutely fine. Francis wanted to hold off on having music. Nonetheless, he wanted something to add a tension to the scene to show what was going on inside Michael. So why don't we listen to the scene, and then I'll talk about what happened.
Great.
Tu basi, sta male. Quandito sta medio. Il cane ti fa un più niun. E mettiamo tutto a posto. Sti fissaria, si deve finire.
Okay, Walter Murch, what are you doing
okay.
there?
Well, what you're looking at in that scene is just two people talking in a relatively abandoned restaurant. What you're hearing, especially leading up to the moment that he pulls the trigger, is a very loud sound of an elevated train going around a corner. Nothing in the scene up to this point has indicated that the trains are anywhere in the neighborhood. It takes place in the Bronx in the late 40s, so you're, I guess, allowed to think that such trains would be in the neighborhood, but you haven't seen anything like that. And nothing, visually speaking, allows you to think that anything like that would be so loud if you did hear it. So that you're presented with a equivalency between what you're looking at and what you're hearing, which doesn't quite add up. It's just a close-up of Michael Corleone, and yet there's this loud screeching sound on the track. When something doesn't add up, the mind of the audience is always anxious to make it add up. And if you can find just the right amount of distance between what you see and what you hear, they will incorporate that distance into something that is related to what they're looking at. In this case, that screeching somehow is a reflection of what's going on inside Michael. So in a strange way, people don't hear that screech. What they see instead is a man making up his mind to kill somebody. So in a weird way, that screeching is kind of the neurons in Michael Corleone's mind just before the moment that he says, "I will do it."
We're featuring an interview recorded last spring with Walter Murch. He just won 2 Academy Awards for his work on The English Patient, one for sound, the other for film editing. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film sound designer and visual editor Walter Murch. Now, you also did the sound for Apocalypse Now. You worked on the sound for Apocalypse Now. And you've brought a scene from that movie to demonstrate what you did. Maybe you could set up the scene for us.
Okay. This is at the beginning of the film, and the Willard character, who's played by Martin Sheen, is cooped up in a hotel room in Saigon. He's found that there's no place in the world for him other than Vietnam. He's tried to go home. He can't. And yet he's stuck in this hotel room, and they won't give him a mission. They won't let him go out into the jungle. So it's a scene of a man stewing in his own juices. What we're looking at is this images of a man trying to pass the time in a hotel room. What you're going to hear is a transition from the street sounds of Saigon to the sounds of the jungle, so that visually there's a discontinuity again. It's a little bit like the screeching train and Michael Corleone's murder, they don't quite add up. You're looking at a man in a hotel room, but you're hearing jungle sounds, and so there's a fruitful discontinuity there that allows you to get inside the character's head.
Let's hear it.
Saigon. I'm still only in Saigon. Every time I think I'm going to wake up back in the jungle, when I was home after my first tour, it was worse. I'd wake up and there'd be nothing. I hardly said a word to my wife until I said yes to a divorce. When I was here, I wanted to be there. When I was there, all I could think of was getting back into the jungle. I'm here a week now, waiting for a mission, getting softer. Every minute I stay in this room, I get weaker. And every minute Charlie squats in the bush, he gets stronger. Each time I looked around, the walls moved in a little tighter.
Very nice. Now, did you record Martin Sheen's voice also?
Yes, yeah.
What were you looking for? There's a kind of a very interior monologue sound to the way his voice is recorded. I think you probably recorded that differently than if he was actually having a conversation with somebody.
Yeah, no, the microphone was, we moved it as close as physically possible to him and then asked him to almost whisper.
Mm-hmm.
So that it gives an interior quality to it that conventional narration, which has a sort of a documentary film feel, would not have. We wanted at all costs to avoid that and to give you some way to get inside the head of this character.
another scene from Apocalypse Now that you did the sound from that you've brought with you. This is a battle scene. Describe what's happening in this.
This is midway in the film, and Willard, again, the Martin Sheen character, is trapped in some trenches. There's a sniper out in the darkness that nobody can seem to kill. And he runs across a group of people, one of whom is a human bat who has great echolocation. And the scene involves getting this person, who likes to sleep a lot because he's of his bat-like nature, to come out and, by echolocation, by listening to this sniper's voice, to kill him with a grenade launcher. Visually, what you're seeing is a full battle. Flashes are going off. It takes place at night. It's very dramatic. But listen to what's happening, and you can hear gradually all of the sound goes away except for the single voice of this sniper who's taunting the GIs in a mixture of Vietnamese and English.
Who's the commanding officer here?
Ain't you? Son, these are bodies, man!
On the wire, man. You hear him?
Do you hear him?
We're busting.
Get him out there on the wire, man.
Yeah.
You need a flare?
No. He's close, man. He's real close.
Hey, soldier. Well, Walter Murch, I bet you listen that way, too. I bet you get so focused on some things you're listening to that everything else kind of falls away.
Well, we all do. I mean, it's the cocktail party effect, you know, where you're able to focus in on somebody's conversation in the middle of a very big party. And even though 50 other people may be yakking away, you can hear what that one person's saying. It's part of everyone's constitution. It's just when you work in sound, you tend to do more of that because it has to do with how you are going to put the film together.
How much footage did you have to edit in Apocalypse Now? Can you give us a sense of how many feet or how many hours worth? How about how many hours worth? That would probably be more meaningful.
Well, the film is just under 2.5 hours long, and there were just under 250 hours of material.
Wow.
So it's roughly 100 hours of material for every hour that made it on the screen. So it's actually amazing that we finished it as quickly as we did.
There must have been hundreds of other stories you could have told with that footage. Did you find yourself shaping the story as you were editing?
Yeah. It's there are a few scenes that were shot that are not in the film. Mostly toward the end of the film. But the script, if you can get a hold of the script, the original script, it's actually not that far from the eventual result.
So why was there so much footage?
Partly the technique by which they filmed the battles. They would load up cameras of... with a 10-minute load of film and have 8 cameras positioned simultaneously and then simply let loose this gigantic, complex machinery of a battle. And it was actually like a battle was taking place in front of your eyes. If you happened to be standing there, you would be less aware of cameras than of there's a battle going on. So it was documentary in a sense. And any documentary has a very large shooting ratio. So there was a high documentary component to Apocalypse Now, where fortuitous things would happen and you would capture those things. But in order to increase your chances of getting something fortuitous, you had to generate a lot of footage to do that.
Could you see the difference between takes? I mean, was it always clear to you which take was the best take?
It's a funny question, because what is good in one context is not good in another. So you have, when you're putting a film together, you have to both create the context and choose things that will fit into that context. It's a little bit like lifting yourself up by your bootstraps. And that's, if there's a mystery to film editing, it's probably that. You probably put your finger right on it. What is good? And what is good is not always obvious. I wish it were. It would make our life simpler. But things that you look at, that part of you says, oh, that's not very good. Another part of you says, but you know, in this context, it actually might be great. There's a scene scene where they're briefing Willard on his mission.
In Apocalypse Now.
In Apocalypse Now. And the Harrison Ford character, the trick of that scene was that Francis told the operator operator of the camera to go wherever he wanted, not to be swayed by whatever anyone was saying. So none of the actors knew when the camera was going to be on them or off them. And there's one scene where Harrison Ford, as an actor, is looking at the camera trying to figure out, is the camera on me or not? But the stare that he gives the camera, and he's looking right into the camera at that point, has an unnerving, actually a wonderful effect, which is it reads as a look to Martin Sheen, a look to Willard that says, we're in a very deep situation here, and I have to play this game by the rules, but I hope you have a lot of luck out there, soldier. So you read a tremendous amount into that look, although the look itself was simply Harrison Ford as an actor trying to figure out, is the camera on me or not? So, it's one of the rules of film editing, of never have the actors look into the camera. Here, that rule is violated, so it's technically a mistake, but within the context of the scene, which is one of a building up paranoia, it actually fits very well.
Walter Murch, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Well, you too. Thank you very much, Terry.
Walter Murch recorded last spring. He won 2 Oscars this week for his work on The English Patient as sound designer and film editor. He's also the author of the book The Blink of an Eye. Coming up, Lives of the Monster Dogs. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that anyone who thinks Lives of the Monster Dogs must be just another mutant life form from outer space story is barking up the wrong tree. Here's her review.
2 things about Lives of the Monster Dogs almost put me off the scent of this superb novel. First, its cheesy title, reminiscent of those Roger Corman horror flicks from the 1960s. Second, the fact that the book's plot, involving a mad scientist and a pack of genetically enhanced dogs, sounded like science fiction, which is a genre that generally leaves me cold. But Kirsten Backus's first novel, Lives of the Monster Dogs, belongs to that category of literary sci-fi occupied by Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, where the emphasis is more on philosophy than physics. And as in those masterpieces, the primary mood of Lives of the Monster Dogs is not suspense, but melancholy. The novel stirs up restive yearnings for improbable worlds and a sobering sense of the limits of this one. The main narrative begins in 2008, when a group of 150 so-called monster dogs appears in Manhattan and takes suites at the Plaza Hotel. The dogs, who are super intelligent and speak through surgically implanted voice boxes, wear prosthetic hands and are dressed in turn-of-the-century military uniforms and bustled skirts. They walk upright with the aids of canes and parasols. The story they tell city officials is a curious one. It seems the dogs are the products of experiments carried on for decades in a remote village in the Canadian wilderness. Their wealthy human masters emigrated to Canada from Prussia in the late 19th century, and because their village was cut off from the rest of the world, both hounds and humans retained the manners and dress of the late Victorian era. There was a bloody uprising against their masters that the polite pooches would prefer not to discuss. Instead, they put on the dog in Manhattan, riding around in limos, orchestrating gala Christmas parades, and basically upstaging moneyed mutts like Donald Trump. A chance meeting throws a college student named Cleo together with a monster dog named Ludwig, who is compiling a history of the dogs and their insane creator. Like many of his more sensitive comrades, Ludwig is tortured by his ludicrous existence. As he says, "It is a terrible thing to be a dog and know it." Ludwig lets Cleo in on a horrifying secret. He and some of the other dogs have been suffering from memory lapses. After one such episode, Ludwig awakes to find piles of feces in the corners of his elegant apartment and scratch marks on the doors. He's reverting and can't stop the process. A weaker writer would have sentimentalized Ludwig and Cleo's relationship into a Beauty and the Beast thing, capable of being redeemed by a kiss. Instead, however, Backus ruthlessly trains our gaze on Ludwig's doomed efforts to retain his autonomy and self-consciousness, turning it into a fable about human struggles with old age and death. Backus's vivid imagination isn't just evident in the plot of her novel, but in its execution as well. Lives of the Monster Dogs reads like a shrunken-down 19th-century novel. Backus tells her tale through letters, diaries, newspaper clippings, and even an opera libretto. Her storytelling powers really shine at the climax of the novel, which takes place in Neuhunstein, a fantastic barbarian-style castle the monster dogs have built and taken refuge in on the Lower East Side. Isolated from the rest of the city, the dogs and their human guests drink and dance themselves into a fatalistic frenzy. Edgar Allan Poe's short story, The Mask of the Red Death, obviously was the inspiration here, and I think the master of the macabre would have been flattered by this canine copy. Lives of the Monster Dogs is one of the most original and affecting novels I've read recently. For such an extraordinary debut, Backus deserves a heaping serving of literary livisnaps.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Lives of the Monster Dogs. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Richard Parker, Al Banks, Fred Snyder, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Regina O'Toole is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Cherie Gross. ¶¶
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.